Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 11th of August 2018. This is probably episode 6 or 7 going through. This article is called by, I don't know who the author is, Sam Wong, Blue Planet, It's a Dark Deep Ocean World. John Copley dived deep for Blue Planet 2. He tells Sam Wong about life in this extreme environment, the perils of plastic, inevitably the one that got away. So this is an interview. This is the introduction to the interview. The BBC documentary series Blue Planet 2 brought the startling and diverse creatures of the deep sea to our screens more intimately than ever before. It featured the first ever dive to 1,000 metres in the Atlantic and ended with a warning about the impact on oceans, particularly from plastic pollutions. Marine biologist John Copley, the University of South Africa in the UK, was a scientific advisor on the series and was on board the Antarctic sub for filming. So Antarctica, it's interesting, it's down our area. The question from, what's it, Sam Wong, when was your first dive in the submersible? And John Copley replies, is it his name? John Copley replies, it was an expedition with the US Navy's Deep Submergence Unit in the Northeast Pacific 23 years ago. As it was a military unit, they inevitably liked to freak out scientists. When we reached the bottom, the pilot stood up and undid the hatch. But of course, the water pressure was holding it in place. It was an astounding experience because the landscape was so different down there. I didn't want to leave. The next question is, what is it like being in a tiny submersible for hours? It's cramped and cold. If you're looking for hypothermal vents in the ocean floor, they're typically 2,000 to 500 metres, 5,000 metres deep. So it's around an 8 to 12 hour dive. If you need to wee, you do it in a bottle. If you've been on several trips where this... The submersible bars have had issues with kidney stones. I think this is because they avoid drinking. Next question. What did you see when making Blue Planet 2 that didn't end up on the final show? My favourite was the Antarctic Sun starfish Pischid Rai, which was nicknamed the Death Star. Unlike starfishes on the UK shore that have 5 arms, this has got about 50. What's unusual is how it feeds. Rather than smothering its prey, it waves its arm up into the water to catch krill. The upper surface of the arm is covered with tiny pincers that snap shut when something bristles past them. It was a challenge to film because the krill followed our submersible lights. If we stopped the sub, the krill swarmed around us. By the time we were ready to film the Death Star, the arms were already full of krill because we had inadvertently brought this amazing dinner. Oh, that's a pretty amazing thing. Okay, Blue Planet 2 showed a moment when your sub started leaking. Everyone seemed surprisingly calm about it. The reply, Metal Hulk subs have portholes with a seal around them. Many of them require high pressure to work properly, so they leak a bit on the way down. What scares me most is a sub fire. You're in a tiny enclosed atmosphere. It could just be smoke from something electrical overheating. But the atmosphere, it will turn toxic fast, which is why we carry backup breathing gear and eye protection. Why send humans down rather than just using remotely operated subs? We reply, the remotely operated vehicles, ROVs, are superb now. Several ships are able to live stream high definition video from one. I can sit at home in the middle of the night with my laptop watching live images from the bottom of the Pacific Ocean interacting with the team and the ship. That's amazing. Yeah, there's something special about immersing yourself in the environment when you're trying to understand it. It might sound anachronistic, but NASA hasn't given up on that ambition either. Question. What else did you learn of the Antarctic expedition? I became aware of the importance of drop stones. when in front of a glacier breaks off the form of the iceberg, it often has rocks stuck on the underside, which vary in size from a fist to as big as a house. And actually, those rocks drop off. They were an exciting moment when our camera sub was filming something on the seabed, and a fist-sized rock dropped through the frame. It was something bigger. If something bigger had hit the rod, that would have been an issue. Most of the Arctic seabed is rich in soft mud because of it's mostly krill poo. The drop stones arrive, and it's rocky island in that landscape. A lot of marine life requires a hard surface to live on. In the Antarctic, that is mainly supplied by drop stones. That's a very interesting thing to know about drop stones. Blue Planet 2, here's a question. Blue Planet 2 brought the deep sea to people's attention a bit more. Do you think people's attitude to oceans have changed recently? To a lot of people, the deep sea embodies a pristine wilderness. There's also a sense that it's alien. That's what first captivated me. But now I think we look at the planet a little bit upside down. We call it a blue planet, yet actually the blue bit's only the surface layer. By area, it's dark, deep ocean planet. And the deep ocean is certainly not pristine. Our everyday lives have been affecting it for a long time. When our great-great-grandparents travelled on steamships, the remains of burnt coals and engines were shovelled over the side. On well-travelled routes, that has shifted the seabed from soft mud to cobbles, which in turn has changed marine life in those areas. Back then, people had no notion of what was happening. Question. Now everyone is worried about plastics. What's the effect it's having on the deep ocean? We simply don't know enough. I imagine life as a sea cucumber deep in the oceans on a fine mud abyssal plain. These animals plough their way through the mud's surface, swallowing, extracting whatever nutrients they can from the organic materials that have fallen from above. Today, a portion of that material is microplastics, which have no nutritional content. Even if these plastics weren't toxic, ingesting it means the sea cucumbers have less energy for reproduction. What does that mean for their populations in the long term? The knock-on effects is uncertain, and that's just one impact of many we have started to appreciate. Why is it so important to explore the deep ocean? To enable us to make informed choices, one choice we face relates to deep sea mining. Some mineral resources are increasingly short supply on land. For example, wind turbines require excellent magnets, which need neodymium. Manganese nodules on the abyssal plains on the eastern Pacific are a particularly rich resource, manganese. Then there's cobalt, which we need for electric car batteries. Proponents of deep sea mining argue that direct impacts of human populations for this kind of mining are fewer, so that many ways this is a less deterrent form of mining. My view is the deep ocean itself should be off limits until we understand more about them. We tend to rush and exploit resources, realize we're having bad impact, then bring in regulations. Here we have an opportunity to do it the other way around. What's your outlook on the mining situation? I'd call myself an optimistic futuristic. If we are smart enough to get down there in deep ocean and explore it, then we are smart enough to come up with alternatives to taking those resources. Next article, entitled Can't Hack It by Sally Andy with a byline, Can we end cyber attacks if we radically redesign the computer chip? Oh, we can. Even if you're not a hacker or coder, chances are that you'll have heard of crimes like Strassnext, NotPetya, and WannaCry. After all, these malicious programs have made big waves in the past few years. First, it was Iran's nuclear centrifuges that were the target, then Ukraine's banks, and last year, hospitals in the UK. These cyber attacks keep on coming. The standard response is to release software patches, the updates that pop up on our computers and smartphones. They're designed to seal up holes that the hackers exploit to smuggle out their malicious code through. The trouble is, there's more than 100,000 holes out there, and that's just the ones we know about. Plenty more are surely waiting to be found. Quote, to successfully defend, you must find all witnesses and plug them, says Linton Salmon, who runs a computer security program in the US Department of Defense. Quote, to successfully attack, you only need to find one. It's a losing battle, and we can no longer afford to fight. As we build the Internet of Things, putting simple processes into garage doors, fridges, light bulbs, and windscreen wipers, that the truth is only going to become plainer. If we're going to put computers in everything, it's time we souped up their defences. That is what Salmon and a few others have been quietly working on. We can protect ourselves from cyber attacks, they say. Not with ever more patches, but with changes to computer design underlying electronics. It means overhauling the way you build microprocessors. But the world's biggest chip manufacturers are already getting in on the action. With a layer of protection at the heart of every chip, the hope is that we will stem the tide of cyber attacks. Most of us use at least two computers a day, whether laptops, tablets, smartphones, smartwatches, and we are used to software like web browsers, spreadsheet doing our bidding. When you strike a key or click an icon, the instruction must ultimately be carried out by the computer's hardware, specifically the processors, which is usually a single microchip. The building blocks of processors are transistors, minuscule electronic switches organized into functional components like memory and logic units, I'd say logic gates. But the software can't communicate directly with transistors. The software is based on words and symbols, whereas transistors understand only two commands, switches on and off. To help the software and hardware communicate, there are go-betweens such as programs called compilers translate software instructions into machine code, a binary language of ones and zeros, ons and offs. Big dumb retriever. How the translation works is determined by the chip's architecture. This is a set of rules embodied in physical design of the processor and governs how the software gets access to the hardware. It determines how much memory a program has access to, for example, quote, think of it like a contact that tells the software people that what to expect from the hardware, says Richard Grisenthwaite of the ARM, a firm that makes processors for most smartphones. The rules vary slightly with the processors, but all architectures are similar, particularly in one respect. Quote, a chip is fundamentally gullible, says Salmon. Give it any instructions that you like, and it says, okay, let me do this as fast as I can. Does this make any sense? I don't care. You ask me to do it, you're the boss. It's like a big, dumb, golden retriever. There's a good reason for this. In the 70s, chips only had about 5,000 transistors. To make processors as fast as possible, none could be wasted. Architectures were designed so whatever software made and demanded chips would comply, no questions asked. So 50 years later, chips in your laptops and smartphone have 5 billion transistors, so that's a million times more. But the golden retriever architecture has remained, largely because changing it would significantly make incompatible with existing software. The unpleasant consequence is that a hacker finds a sneaky way into a processor is only too happy to oblige any request. It means that it's possible to harvest sensitive data like usernames and passwords or get the processor to do nefarious deeds. The idea of making chips less gullible is not new. More than a decade ago, computer scientist Ruby Lee at Princeton University published designs of a processor which would wipe parts of its memory automatically after a period of time. Back then, the big chip manufacturers weren't interested, but that's starting to change for a few reasons. For one thing, 5 billion is a lot of transistors. Processors are now fast enough that we could afford to drop the speed when we devote a few security checks. For another, we are increasingly spooked by hacks. The security is becoming a selling point. It's not just Lee who has long seen the need for better security. In 2010, Howie Strobe, a computer scientist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, went to the US government's Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, DARPA, where it launched a program known as CRASH. It proposed a simple question. Given everything we know about security today, how would we design a computer infrastructure, hardware and software, servers, networks, the lot, if we started from scratch? The biggest problem the project could identify was how interconnected computers are, giving hackers easy access to a lot of information. But that horse has long since bolted. So CRASH homes in on the way we forward redesigning the hardware. Sam picked up CRASH where CRASH left off. He trawled the world's most authoritative list of known computer vulnerabilities kept by the MITRE Corporation, a non-profit organization based in Massachusetts, and identified the most common hardware ones. There turned out to be 7 main classes of hardware vulnerability, which together account for almost half the known hacks, deep hacks below left. In 2000, 2017, Samen launched a program called System Security Integrated Through Hardware and Firmware, SITH. I don't know how that goes where. It's got the out there. If it is giving 9 competing research teams a share of $60 million to develop processes integratable to all 7 classes of attacks by March 2020. No one has tried anything this ambitious before. The gold standard of hardware defense is formal verification, a way of using fiendishly complicated maths to prove that the hardware does only what it should do. It requires rigorous checks to be made, which takes time. So far, it's only been used in custom-made chips for applications where human life is at stake, for example, in flight control systems. That is changing. Quote, I looked into formal methods a few years ago and was pretty disappointed, said Ben Lorry, the head of security at Google-owned artificial intelligence firm DeepMind. Quote, but then I looked again, and more recently I was surprised by the amount of progress. Salmon is similarly confident. He says improvements in algorithms should make formal verification of hardware practical by 2020. Adam Chibler at MIT is working on a processor design that uses formal verification as part of SITH. Quote, we're building a compiler that automatically implements the IDM, he says. At the moment, however, his method only works for parts of chips, as it's uncertain how quickly it can be scaled up. A good backstop option might not be to assistance, however, thanks to another line of research for SITH. Instead of radically redesigning processes, you can give them a partner to help them out. The idea is being taken forward by Draper, an engineering non-profit company headquartered in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Inside the main processor, every kind of data is given a tag that specifies what security policies it must adhere to. These policies are held on an adjacent coprocessor that vets every action the main processor takes. If anything breaks the rules, a flinty-eyed coprocessor stops it. It tries to find another way to execute. The coprocessor shuts down the program. Draper calls this an inherently secure processor. This setup allows chip manufacturers to the best of both worlds. Should someone identify a new hardware vulnerability, the policies in the coprocessor can be updated without messing around the main chip. Quote, a new policy can be deployed almost immediately, says Draper scientist at Curtis Walker. It's as fast as a software update and as strong as changing the hardware. Still, even if this prevents people from stealing passwords, continual attacks would force programs to shut down. That's far from ideal, especially if the program is controlling something critical, like electricity grid or nuclear power plant. Robert Watson, who studies secure computers architectures from Cambridge University, is working on a third way, which is called, can I say, the way that I do it. I had a robot factory with 3 or 4 robots and 20 computers, and they would be just disconnected from the internet. They'd form its own little internet, and there'd be a firewall from, I suppose, you still can get into it. His architecture called Cambridge SRI International, a research institute in California. His architecture called Cherry traps malicious software, partitioning it off so it can do little damage. Think of what happens when everyday software like Microsoft Word freezes on your computer. You're forced to quit with a few clicks. This won't affect other applications. Cherry works out a similar way at the hardware level. Let's say the hacker emails you a cropped image that, if clicked on, will trick your email software into sending malicious code to the processor. A processor using Cherry architecture will construct a perimeter wall that isolates the compromised part of the processor. This wall is reconfigurable so it can trap the enemy code in one mailbox, one email, or even just a cropped image itself. Attackers can get in, but they find themselves with nowhere to go. Some infrastructure already uses incredibly secure chips, nuclear power plants, for example. The people who run them are even more paranoid than I am, says Salmon. But those chips are expensive and slow, optimized for one job. You couldn't use them for a smartphone or your laptop. Switching the processors in those everyday computers for something more secure would mean a huge upheaval. Quote, it's already not that simple to replace the systems that are out there, says Katie Masuris, an information security researcher at Microsoft's Bug Bounty program, which pays hackers to report software vulnerabilities. So, will it ever happen? There are reasons to be optimistic, Sarah Lepper, an engineer of DAPA who works at a spin-off company called Dover Microsystems that is already marketing a commercial version of the inherently secure processor. Lepper says the firm is in touch with electricity grid operators who want to use it. The major microchip manufacturers have begun to take less radical steps towards making hardware that helps constrain the software that runs on it. Quote, "We are already working on our own hardware security projects," says Ron Single, engineer, senior fellow at Intel. "Even the cheapest chips, those in devices that might be connected to the Internet of Things, could be switched. ARM's primary interest goes beyond phones is in such devices." And Grissenthwaite says the firm has long been watching Watson's Cherry architecture. Quote, "We are already interested in what he is doing, but the hardware security is unlikely to end cyber attacks completely. The ground is littered with the bodies of all the people who have solved cyber security," said Samson. "That's likely because there will always be old systems in our computer infrastructure, not to mention attacks that rely on human gullibility. Phishing, for example, or someone putting a sticky note bearing their password on their monitor. Sooner or later, something very important will be attacked, perhaps a power grid, bank, hospital, with major consequences. That's why it's good to think about hardware overhaul," says Lim. Quote, "We need chips that can use the day after the catastrophe," she says. "If change doesn't happen before that day, it will happen after, and it will happen fast."
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.